Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard. Well, hello, and welcome to Mindfulness at Work. We are here again with Laura Berland and Evan Harrell, the Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer for the Center for Compassionate Leadership. Our conversation was so robust and we didn't get half of what we wanted in. So we're here with part two. Welcome, Laura and Evan.
Oh, thank you, Cara. It's been such a pleasure and we're delighted to continue the conversation.
Yes, thank you so much.
Yes, so we kind of ended last time and we were talking a little bit about all the research and evidence-based work you do. And you also mentioned two upcoming offerings that you have this fall. And I was wondering if we could start there with you telling us what your programming is for corporate America or anyone who wants to join and how it came to be from your research and evidence-based learnings.
You bet. So this coming fall, we're offering 2 8-week programs in compassionate leadership and resilience training. And it goes through the process of developing the skills to be able to lead compassionately. We start with the important area of awareness and mindfulness. Awareness is a very important skill for organizational leaders, for parents, for anyone to be able to have, to be able to truly see what is going on and just observe it as it is, because there's so much that happens that will trigger our emotions and cause us to start projecting out into the world and changing our perception of what truly is. And building on that foundation of awareness, we then focus on self-compassion, which is such a critical skill, because if we don't know how to accept ourselves as we are, if we don't deal with our own wounds, we will turn around and we will project our wounds onto other people. So it's very, very important for parents, for people in the workplace to be able to be accepting of themselves. And there is so much evidence around the importance of both of those, awareness and self-compassion and their productivity. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we move into proven business development, leadership development skills around creating psychological safety, around being able to communicate with compassion, about fostering a growth mindset, and about creating a sense of connection to everyone so that we don't limit ourselves to just being connected to the people who are most like us. And again, all of those are evidence-based practices that lead to superior outcomes and ultimately allow us to be able to go forth into the world, to be able to learn how to fail and learn from the failure, which is essentially what resilience is, and be able to be willing to go forth and take risk another time.
Mm, wonderful. Well, thank you for explaining that. And so much just came up for me because I think that it's interesting that it's based in evidence that the degree to which you heal your own wounds and have an awareness of who you are and why you're triggered or why you act in the way that you do is the degree to which you are going to have successful relationships. So if you want surface level relationships and you're afraid to go there, which many people are, hey, and I don't blame them, it's hard work. But if you want to go in and become aware of what your wounds are and why you're that way, you will have an awareness of those projections and you won't be projecting your wounds onto others as a leader, as a parent, or whatever relationship you're in. And so you will have a healthier and therefore more successful relationship. It's interesting because when a leader is mean to us or acts out, or a parent tries to heal themselves on their child, it's just because they have a wound. So you can even have compassion for them, but they're not going to get out of the relationship what they want, whether it's productivity in the workplace or a deep connection in a parent-child relationship. So I now at this age know that if someone's mean or makes a comment to me, I can totally say that's about them and not me, but it took me a long time to get to that place. Can you tell me what the evidence is behind that or the science? Because I'd love to hear that because I'm so intrigued by it.
You bet. So the science behind our ability to relate to others starts from the way that we see ourselves. And so it is very difficult for us to be able to relate to other people in a healthy manner if we are in the midst of treating ourselves in challenging ways. There are over 2,000 studies related to self-compassion and the benefits that self-compassion bring. And among that enormous body of work are research papers that show how it impacts us in positive ways in families, in one-on-one relationships, in the workplace, and in all sorts of other settings. So it's a very robust body of work.
Can you give me an example from all of those areas that you just mentioned? You mentioned a relationship, you mentioned as a parent, you mentioned as a leader, and I'd love to know how self-compassion can really heighten the levels of productivity or deep relationship that you have with someone else, with a child, and with someone in the workplace?
Yeah, wonderful question. So I can just use myself as an example, going back 30, 40 years. Before I really understood the power of self-compassion and self-love and the idea that I didn't need external validation to make myself feel held and nurtured and supported. When I became a parent almost 30 years ago, what I would have given for this understanding and awareness, I have no words for it, because I was so caught up in my own stuff and the negative self-talk and the chasing external validation. And I was in the middle of a very successful entrepreneurial venture. And so instead of focusing inward and paying attention to what my heart truly desired, which was to be present to my son, to be present to my feelings of deep motherly connection, I was off chasing some, ring on the carousel that didn't really even have that much meaning when I look through my lenses now. But back then, somehow that seemed more important to me.
So, and reaching for the next ring was,
yeah, chasing this external validation instead of knowing that I could nurture and support myself from the inside out, and that I didn't need anything outside of me to let me know that I was enough, that I deserve to be here, that I deserve to have a rich, happy, healthy life. And I, to this day, I have conversations with my son. I'm like, didn't I mess you up somehow? Fortunately, he's like, no, Mom, it was all Teflon. Don't worry.
Well, my kids tell me I mess them up majorly. I'm kidding. But no, I mean, they have the right, I think, to express what things worked for them and what didn't. And even the most conscious people probably can mess something up within a relationship. But what I find interesting with your personal story, Laura, and thank you so much for sharing that, because I think the listeners can so relate to that, is that we often trick ourselves into thinking, but I'm doing this for my son, right? And so tell me what you think about me saying that and how that feels to you.
Profound, because I know at the time that was all part of the logical swirl to validate my behavior versus listening more deeply to a truer intention. So I hear that loud and clear.
In terms of published research, which I find might appeal to some people, because I find Laura's story much more relatable. But I would refer anyone who's interested to Kristen Neff's website, which is self-compassion.org. Mm-hmm. She has been she's published some of the best research in the field herself. And I know you're very well aware of Dr. Neff. But she is so generous about getting all the research that is available and making it publicly available to her. She has a whole section on family research that talks about attachment to your children, the strength of the relationship with a partner or a spouse, the impact on anxiety, depression, impact on the ability to have structure or order when a child goes to college. But I mean, there are literally thousands of these research papers there, and it's very, very powerful and very compelling.
So I've read some of her work and I've heard her, and interestingly, there's such a tie, and maybe one of you could explain and articulate it in a way that is easy for the mind to grasp, but there's such a tie between self-compassion, a growth mindset, and resiliency. And since your program is on being resilient, can you show us how the thread goes between those three areas?
So I think it all revolves around what happens when something doesn't go the way you want it to, the way you plan it to, the way it should, you would like it to happen. A self-compassionate person can recognize that they will go through life and everything will not work out just right. They will make decisions that end up being that not working out. Sometimes they'll make mistakes. They'll do the wrong thing. They'll forget to do something which has negative consequences. The self-compassionate person is able to recognize that's part of what it means to be a human. And they can say, okay, I can't believe I did that. And that was really costly. I really hurt my child. I really upset my friend. I don't want to do that again. How could I not do that again? And so if you're able to remove yourself a little bit and say, how could I not do that again? You're going to be more likely to not do it again.
Yeah.
If on the other hand, you're like, oh, you're such an idiot. I can't believe you did that. You want to move beyond it so fast. You don't want to think about it. Because with respect to a growth or a fixed mindset, you don't want to dwell on the fact that you made a mistake, because that means you're a failure. You are an idiot. You are what happened. So self-compassion is simply recognizing with kindness and awareness that we are all human, just like anyone else. And amazingly, it allows us to offer to ourselves what is much easier for us to offer to others.
Yes, that is so beautifully put and such a lovely example, Evan. You know, I think a lot of us do the berating and then we want to shut down and pretend it didn't happen because it was so embarrassing. And I used to say when I was first trained as a coach, you know, you need to look at some of these situations just from a bird's eye view with curiosity and wonder. And of course, Dan Siegel, appropriately and aptly coined the term mindsight, as opposed to me saying, you know, look at yourself from a bird's eye view. But I love that mindsight where you're not saying, just say to yourself, oh, who cares? You made a mistake. You're actually saying, say, oh gosh, you know, that was costly. I love your words. That was costly. But we're going to move forward. And what can you learn so that it doesn't cost you again, as opposed to, you know, just blowing it off, or a combination of berating yourself and then blowing it off, which does nothing to foster a growth mindset. It does nothing to foster resilience. You might not try that again. You might just shut down. You know, it might have hurt you so much or made you so anxious, where I think a lot of people do shut down and don't try things because they're so afraid of that anxious feeling ever happening to them again. And we actually know we can all get through it.
Such a great point. And allowing yourself to feel the emotions and what's coming up is crucial. Yes, our natural tendency for most of us, I don't want to feel that, and push it down and shut it out and go away. And self-compassion allows you to really have the tools to acknowledge and name and live with the emotions and the feelings that come up, because as you said, they do pass. It's just that we're so afraid of them that we don't take time to really build the capacity to allow them to show up and dissipate. Mm-hmm. And if you don't allow that movement of the feelings and the emotions, which are essentially energy, to go through you, then this is how we build up trauma. I mean, this is how we get stuck with our negative feelings and emotions. And then it all just cascades and explodes.
Right, exactly. And Laura, you're describing, again, Dan Siegel's process of name it to tame it. And I think that's a really good process for children, but I think, and families, but I think it could happen in the corporate setting too, that even for yourself, if you messed up a project, name it to tame it instead of burying it or berating yourself.
Absolutely. And for leaders especially, when they show up in a way that is open and accepting, not only of what the people around them do, but of their own failures, they are modeling vulnerability. And that is the essence of building trust, of building a deeper connection and relationship, because then everybody can relate to them. Oh, they're not some perfect figure up there on a pedestal. They're just like me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of a leader who made a transformation for both themselves, their team, or their corporate setting from implementing some of these things that we're talking about?
Jeff Weiner, who's the executive chairman of LinkedIn, talks an awful lot about compassion and self-compassion and the transformation that he made both on a personal basis first, you know, from being a somewhat difficult person, a little challenging, and not really surrounding himself with emotional intelligence skills and compassion and vulnerability, to recognizing and becoming a much more compassionate individual, and then bringing those skills into the core values of LinkedIn. And he has been probably the most outspoken executive in the business world about the importance of building compassion and trust in the organization, and attributes a huge amount of LinkedIn's success to the ability of everyone to respect each other and operate on this basis of trust. because that allows us to make faster decisions. We're not covering our behinds. We're not looking to blame other people. We're just meeting, trusting, moving forward. Yes, no, da, da, da. And it's a very, very powerful concept that you see sort of filtering out from LinkedIn and into the rest of the business world.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful culture you just described, as opposed to people who are constantly trying to stomp on someone or undermine someone or living in fear that someone's going to be doing that to them, which is, I think, more the norm, unfortunately. You know, the judgment of other people's home or personal life or what their work product is just because they're not there or whatever it might be. There, we make a lot of judgments. And so as opposed to building a culture of trust and community, and everybody engages and contributes to the greater of the whole. And so, and applaud to him because he really has now built a really great company that is award-winning and that people talk about their culture. Even, you know, people I know say that it's a great place to work. So in that vein, can you describe to me who would be like, do you like to do a team of people to come in and do your resilience training this fall? Or tell me how that would look. Would it be team leaders from different companies so that they all, can learn from one another? Or how will the structure of the curriculum go for different people?
The quick answer is all of the above.
Okay.
our two publicly facing offerings that are scheduled at this point will be groups of around 25 participants. One is focused exclusively on the global health field, and they will be the past cohorts have been from all over the world, from Asia, from Africa, from Europe, Latin America, the United States, Australia,
and Canada.
And so that's got a specific focus on global health, which has some distinctive ways that compassionate leadership manifests itself there. The other is for a general population, which is typically more U.S. focused, but it is a global cohort. And that is from a wide range of fields. But the issues that present themselves we've named many of the skills that the leadership development skills, but the issues of awareness and self-compassion and psychological safety and belonging and the like are common in all fields. And so people get the chance to express how they are seeing. These challenges in their own areas.
They both
and we also we do programs that are organization specific. Can be a retreat, for example, a 3-day retreat. We're doing an event this summer that'll be a 4-hour sort of mini workshop. Not equivalent to our full 8-week courses, but cover some specific topics. In conjunction with a medical society annual convention.
Wonderful. Well, they sound like phenomenal offerings, and people are, would be lucky to participate in them because can you describe the transformation the transformation that takes place and the feedback you've received from people who have participated, what the difference is in their companies moving forward and how that's helped the bottom line.
Yeah. It's so interesting because we were on a phone call earlier today with a particular organization, and one of their leaders had participated in a public course. And today we were scoping out how they wanted to bring this work into their organization. And a colleague described the woman who had been through the training as like a before and after case. And that was almost, a bit shocking to us because we don't get to see everything. We're together, you know, a couple hours a week on Zoom, and then, you know, there's the rest of life. And this colleague acknowledged that she had, you know, completely shifted and started every meeting in a collaborative and inclusive way, and had really noticed a shift in her persona, and, you know, all of this beautiful, sort of really tangible transformation that we don't get to see every day. But we do hear, for instance, we had a country director in Ethiopia during a class, as we were talking about people who gave too much and didn't take care of themselves enough, back to the self-compassion, he was like, I thought I was the only one who was feeling depleted, who was feeling overwhelmed, who was feeling, you know, and he was on the top of a very large organization and didn't have anybody to talk to or to share with. And this opportunity to be in community with leaders of various, you know, elevations, it doesn't really matter where they are in an organization. It's just that these leaders get to recognize that what they're feeling and what they're experiencing are shared challenges. And that takes such a load off people, just to know that they're not the only one and that they can talk about it and they can get support from the rest of the community. We create very collaborative, co-creative environments for these leaders so that they get to work through their personal and organizational issues together. And that really is the transformation.
There's an aspect of compassion work that people don't talk about. It's almost as if you're not supposed to be talking about this, because somehow it is the it is a sign of weakness, that this isn't a strong skill. And we, of course, believe that it takes an enormous amount of strength to be compassionate. But what happens is that when people start talking to each other and they start recognizing that everyone is looking for this same thing, one of the things that we've seen is that people have had the courage to bring into their organizations things that they thought might not be well received. And in so doing, what they found is there were other people around them just waiting for one person to speak up, one person. So something as simple as starting a meeting with a brief moment to center and calm down, and then make a connection within the room on a sincere level, and slowly sinks down, instead of just going cutting right to the other business matters at hand. And so part of it is helping everyone recognize the shared common humanity we have, that we all actually hunger for this human connection. We all hunger for this understanding that I hurt and everyone else hurts as well. And it's okay that this is how I feel. And so that's been, for me, one of the most energizing aspects of doing this, is realizing that we're really trying to help people find their own voice and speak up for what their true needs are. And in so doing, they're finding out that other people have the same needs. Mm.
It sounds like imperative, for lack of a better word. I mean, if you know the psychology behind feeling isolated and lonely and what that can lead to. You know, let's start with just anxiety. We can move to trauma, and then we can move for suicidal ideation, or in the worst case, suicide. When you feel that isolated, that's where you can head. And it's actually not so far-fetched to think of that. And so the preventative measure that you're describing is imperative to me. So I applaud you in that work. And that man who said he didn't know anyone else felt that way just made me feel so such an amount of empathy for him and then actual gratitude for the work you do, because it sounds so impactful and necessary.
It is this veil that we are all living under of just feeling like we can't speak out about our true feelings or pain or suffering or what ails us, or asking for help. Something as simple as asking for help, it's not a sign of weakness, but we're so conditioned to want to show this armor of protection and perfection. And it really works so much against our well-being. It's tragic.
Yeah, it really is. And something as simple, you know, as beginning and ending a meeting with, hey, what's going on for you? What do you want to get out of this meeting? What do you appreciate about these meetings? Something like that can sound so fluffy and irritating to some people, but how silly is it to start a meeting in a stuffed shirt, like, let's get after it and hurry up? People's mind don't work that way. You know, it's very hard to walk into a room and get after it. You're not going to ease into it and be as productive as you would be if you, you know, kind of center the room on the fact that you're in it together, that you're actually collectively going to be participating, as opposed to kind of whiplash the other way around. So people think they should walk in and have an air about them, and it's actually just the opposite.
So true. So true. We teach a whole range of, we call them everyday practices. They're just simple little, you know, 10 second, 60 second things that people do individually or in groups that can shift the energy and attention like that.
Right.
And one of the things about compassion is it can be applied in all situations. So, you're going to be having in an organizational setting, you're going to be having an employee review. Well, you can be compassionate in that review or not, and still set the goals, still explain what happened and whatever changes you want and whatever celebrations you want. It's not like it takes any more time, takes any sort of special overlay. It just takes intention. It just takes practice to be able to recognize that every interaction you want to have compassionately. You want to have with understanding of the other person's feelings.
Yeah, it seems so simple, doesn't it, Evan? But we don't attack it that way. And we come in and think, again, if we're saying, we're so uncomfortable with saying, you know, you didn't reach your goals and you have to. And here's what they are. What is the difference whether you say it, you know, what you're really energetically saying when you have no compassion is that you're scared to say it. When you should have compassion to say it, but be firm in it. People want to know that they're expected to reach a goal that you've set forth, but you can have compassion in joining them in how they go about reaching that goal and still being clear that it is still a goal. So I guess because we're not taught it from a young age, we're taught that saying something that isn't exactly what the other person wants to hear should be uncomfortable and create consternation. And actually, I just think that to be so untrue. I wish we could get more comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Absolutely. And it's not compassionate.
Yeah.
To not be clear. It's not compassionate when you need to say something that is hard to hear, that is challenging to receive, to candy coat it and make it anything other than it is. There are things that need to be said that are hard to say and hard to hear. And it's not compassionate to avoid saying them or to say them in ways that downplay what it is. And I mean, that's summarized in Brené Brown's phrase that clear is kind and unclear is unkind. So when we start, you know, trying to be gentle in delivering bad news, all we do is muddy the water. All we do is create lack of clarity. And that is not kind. That is not compassionate.
Yes. I mean, if I had a dollar for every time I use that phrase, I tell people to have it as their mantra, clear as kind. You know, you have to talk to your ex-husband that way. You have to talk to your kids that way. You have to talk to your employees that way. It's across the board, and clear is really kind. I find sensitive people. So here's a nuance, and I'd love, and let's end with this, with both of you guys just helping me through this. There's a difference between, you know, allowing someone to problem solve on their own and not problem solving it for them, and them not getting where you're going. So as a coach, sometimes that's very hard. I think some people are very sensitive. And so you're kind of asking them if they have the answer within themselves or what they think, and they get very frustrated because they just want you to tell them. Do you guys ever have that with some leaders?
Certainly some leaders would like the hack,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, get me from point A to point B, and they want to jump over the pond of the inner work.
Yep.
They just don't want to go there because it can be messy. It can be hard. It's raw. It's real. It's life. And they've been skating along on the surface of the frozen pond, and they haven't gotten into the muck that's below. But the muck that's below is where all the richness of life really exists.
Yes.
And where the growth exists.
Wonderful. Well, the muck elicits growth. And so we all have to, in order to get out, we have to go through it, right? And we can't skip over it. So that's a wonderful way of putting it. Thank you.
And I think it was Margaret Mead who said, we shouldn't teach people what to think. We should teach them how to think. And that's the hard part, is many people just want, just tell me what to do.
Right.
And, you know,
yeah, we're not raising critical thinkers who can therefore get into corporate America and problem solve. They want to know what do you want me to do, when we just saw in, you know, glaring lights that the pandemic taught us that, you know, nothing can be planned, as you said at the beginning, Evan. So we can, you know, kind of come back to that. You have to know that nothing can be planned, and that you're still going to survive, and that you still can get through it, even though you don't know what's ahead, because the pandemic every day, just when we thought we were going to open up, we closed down. When we thought we, you know, had gotten the numbers under control, we didn't. When we thought, you know, we were going to have a vaccine rollout, it was, you know, a little slower than expected. All kinds of things that really prevented us at each and every step from, you know, getting the kids back to school, whatever it was, that we can't plan on really anything, and we still will make it through. So that's resiliency, right? Well, thank you guys both for being here. As we end, do you want to give any information about the sign up for either of those courses that are coming up in the fall?
Thank you for opening that invitation to us. And what I would suggest right now is that people subscribe to our weekly newsletter, which is full of just wonderful information, not just our own, but many references, scientific papers, as well as a lot of thought leadership about the discipline of compassionate leadership. And then as soon as we have the dates, we will announce those dates. We also have a page on our website where they can get more details about the courses coming up.
If they go to our website, which is centerforcompassionateleadership.org, there is a programs section which shows our different offerings, and mm-hmm. they can see that there.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Part two was as enjoyable as part one. I really appreciate you two and the center and the gift that you are to the world's leaders, and then therefore everyone in the world.
You too, Cara. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cara.
It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.